Lisa Genova has a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard University. She is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Still Alice, Left Neglected, Love Anthony, and Inside the O'Briens. Still Alice spent 59 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and has been translated into 37 languages. It was adapted into a film starring Julianne Moore, Alec Baldwin, Kristen Stewart, Kate Bosworth, and Hunter Parrish. Some great actors there. Her new book, More or Less Maddie, will be released on January 14th. There is so much to discover about Lisa Genova, and we are delighted to have her as a guest today to help us pave new neural roads. And if you're one of the almost 9 million viewers of her 2017 TED Talk, you understand. Welcome to the first 50 pages, Lisa.
Oh my goodness, thank you for having me.
So, More or Less Maddie is your seventh book and your sixth novel. Your novels are inspired by neurological conditions, including Alzheimer's disease, traumatic brain injury, Huntington's disease, and ALS. And one of the things readers say that really sets you apart as a writer is in the way that you tell the story. You know, you really root them in our shared human condition. And on your website, lisagenova.com, you describe yourself as an empathy warrior. What does that mean to you and how you approach the way that you write?
Right. So my background is in neuroscience, and I could write primarily nonfiction, right? I could write very clinical, medical textbook kind of narratives, but I choose to write fiction, which is a very strange thing for a neuroscientist to do. And it's because I have found that there's so much power in story and the ability to help create compassionate understanding and empathy, our ability to walk in someone else's shoes who might be so unfamiliar to us prior to reading the story becomes familiar and therefore less uncomfortable and more human. And so, yeah, with every book I write, I choose a topic about a person living with a neurological disease, a disorder, a condition, a mental illness, people who are generally ignored, feared, and misunderstood for what's going on inside their brains. And the story is a path to empathy. And so, yeah, I spend a lot of time advocating for folks with those conditions, using the stories as a vehicle for open conversation.
So let's talk about More or Less Maddie. Can you tell us a little bit about this story?
Yeah. So this story is about a young woman who, she's an NYU student, and she's, as the book opens, she's sort of questioning the validity of striving for a so-called normal life in our culture. And, you know, is there happiness to be found within the constraints of what culture deems as normal? And as she's sort of navigating the stress of being a student and a recent breakup and the sort of challenges of being a young woman today, she is experiencing a bit of a depression and is having trouble keeping up with schoolwork, goes on an antidepressant, and then that actually catapults her into her first manic episode, and she's diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So this story is about her diagnosis, her treatments and struggles with medications and side effects, and the quest to sort of find herself and who she is outside of this sort of imposed identity of bipolar disorder and how to live and thrive with it. And she ends up choosing a path very outside of normal, a career of stand-up comedy.
Which is a really interesting counterpoint to the story. And yeah, it's really interesting to see how that evolves for her as a character. So we're excited to talk more about that for sure. So this is your first novel about a disorder that's classified as a mental illness. Was writing about a mental illness different for you in ways that were unexpected?
Yes and no. So it's, you know, it's so interesting, and I'm very excited to be in conversation about this. That anything is categorized as a mental illness is a completely made up term. I mean, all of them are really, whether it's a neurological disease, a neurological condition, a neurodegenerative disease, these are just labels we put on behaviors and disease and conditions that have to do with the brain. And so interestingly, if we're talking about depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, anxiety disorders, PTSD, those get lumped into a new category called mental illness. And while I think there's a certain amount of stigma that goes along with anything having to do with anything going on from the neck up, like I think there's a certain kind of taboo if you've got something going wrong with your brain, there is a heightened stigma, shame, taboo that happens for folks who get labeled mentally ill. I think that it unfortunately carries with it a level of distrust and dismissiveness when that is your label. I also recognize that part of the reason I think they get labeled mental illness, one is the sort of category of behavior that it's tends to be mood and personality centered, but also that we today don't really understand much about the biology of those conditions, as opposed to something like Alzheimer's or Huntington's or ALS, where we have more of a grasp of what's actually causing those things. We know very little about what causes bipolar disorder. And so in that sense, my research for this book was leaned more heavily on the people living with it and their loved ones, and less so on the medical professionals who diagnose and treat, although they were there too, but they weren't taking center stage.
And you really do get that from Maddie's experiences throughout the book, in her interactions with her family and boyfriend and friends, coworkers. You really kind of get, I mean, it is something she wants to hide. And she's, there, you really feel that shame that she doesn't want people to know this about her because of the stigmas attached. That really comes through, I think, through in the story.
Thank you. Yeah, I think she's worried that she'll be excluded from belonging, right? If people find out that she has this, then that's how they'll see her. She at times talks about, like, her mother. Can her mother sort of unsee this and still, see her as a daughter first and not a broken daughter? So it's definitely a journey for everyone I came to know who has bipolar disorder. I think people go through the stages of grief over sort of what they had imagined their life was going to be without bipolar. And then now there's this new reality that they have to come to accept over time and adjust to.
And I think part of Maddie's story that was really powerful to me is that she already, is in this kind of space where she feels already like an outsider within her own family. So there has to be like a certain level that she's feeling of, well, really now I have something else that, is contributing to me feeling like this black sheep that yeah. I thought was really powerful.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think in a very sort of strange way that the diagnosis helped catapult her in the direction she kind of wanted to go in. Like, she didn't really want to live the life her mother's living, to live the life her sister signed up for, to sort of, all the shoulds and supposed tos. She did want to find something different for herself. Like, school wasn't really speaking to her. She wasn't finding her major. She wasn't finding a career within the constraints of a standard kind of liberal arts education. So I think that this actually helped her have the courage to seek something that was outside of what was expected of her previously.
Yeah, kind of a freedom in that to explore something else.
Yeah.
And while you talk about in the book that bipolar, you're not ever cured from this. It's something you'll live with for your whole life. Essentially, if you're diagnosed, it's just really kind of how you manage that. But you highlight, we get to a point where and I don't want to have any spoilers, but you can live with it, right? Like, it managed in the right way. It is something that people can live productively.
Yes, absolutely. I think what I've learned is it's an incredibly difficult disorder to live with, especially if you don't have the right tools and guardrails in place. So finding the right combination of medications that work for you, that you can tolerate, the meds for this disorder they're really tough. They're not designed for bipolar disorder. They're serendipitously discovered drugs for other things that are being applied to bipolar disorder. And so there's a non-specificity, which means that it acts pretty like promiscuously throughout the brain. And you have a lot, which means you have a lot of side effects. And so most people, until they figure out the right combination and dosage, live for periods of time where you could argue that the symptoms of their side effects are actually worse than the symptoms of the illness itself. So it really is a struggle. But landing on the right medications will definitely help to reduce the reoccurrence and the severity, should they recur, of manic episodes and depressive episodes. So you'll stay in sort of a normal mood state for longer and less severe if you swing outside. In addition to that, it's having the support of family, friends, a therapist, people who can help you identify what might be your early warning signs and triggers, and can sort of be in collaboration with you on staying stable.
You know, Jen and I, working in an urban public library setting, we, you know, pretty often see people that are dealing with the kind of symptoms that Maddie has in her first manic episode. And while Maddie's episode, you know, was very scary and heartbreaking and for some probably almost unbelievable, for people who've experienced this or have, you know, been witness to someone having an episode, it felt very authentic to, you know, what we've seen, what, you know, others have seen. Could you share a little bit more about your research for this story?
The people I interviewed, so I did a ton of reading. I read textbooks, I read memoirs, I did a ton of research on the page. But then I came to know 9 people who have bipolar disorder, and then lots of friends and family, both of those 9, and then people who aren't related to them. And these folks really were incredibly trusting and kind and generous with me, spending lots of their time sharing their most intimate moments, their most vulnerable moments, where things really were outside of their control in their own lives. Very scary times for them. And it's incredibly humbling, and also gives me an incredible sense of responsibility to take what I've learned and then go tell the truth under the imagined circumstances of this story.
Yeah. One of the things that we often struggle with in the public library setting is when we have to call for outside help or assistance.
Okay.
And there's an interesting point in the story, you know, where I think a doctor says to Maddie, "You're lucky that an experienced officer responded to this call."
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So she's having her first manic episode. She comes home for Thanksgiving, and Maddie has bipolar 1, which means she has full manic episodes with delusions. So her thoughts have become detached from reality, in addition to all of the sort of grandiose thinking and the risk-taking and the excessive amounts of energy and lack of sleep. So she comes to believe that she has a special relationship with Taylor Swift and that she's going to be writing Taylor's memoir. And she's actually, on this particular manic episode, she's planning to get to Taylor's house in Rhode Island because she believes that she has a meeting with Taylor to discuss the book project. And she's trying to get the keys to her mother's car, and her mother won't give them to her. I won't give it away because there's a big scene that ensues that should be pretty shocking to read. The mother ends up calling the police on her daughter, and she's taken to a hospital. And I did talk with I have a friend who's a Boston police officer who I spent a lot of time with when I was doing the research for Inside the O'Briens, because in that book, my main character is a police officer. And so this was a conversation I brought to him. I said, "Hey, if you're called to the house, here's the situation. You know, how do you handle it? Do you arrest her or do you bring her to the ER?" And he explained that he actually gave me that little nugget. Like, well, if I were new, I might arrest her because I don't know what's happening. She just seems psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
And dangerous. But if I've been on the force for a long time, I know that this person actually needs medical attention and not jail.
Yeah. It was a really powerful scene.
We're like trying to think of like what to say without like giving any spoilers away. It's a hard line.
I need to stop. Yeah. Because that scene is like that. My editor in the first draft, when she wrote in the comments, she's like, "Wow, that must have been was that something like, was that as breathless to write as it was to read? And I was like, it was. I was actually out of breath writing it.
Yeah. And we know that words matter. And in reading your book, I've been thinking more about the words that I default to. So now I'm actively trying to trade mental illness for mental health in conversation. And even thinking about how to refer to people who have bipolar instead of that they are bipolar. That was such an interesting point in the book that Maddie makes such a good argument for in the book. One other thing that I picked up along the way, it was subtle. I kind of caught it in passing, but I'm so glad that you included it in the story. This idea that women, I think especially, are called bipolar as a slander, right? Mm-hmm. If they show emotion or get upset. And I think that does play into the social stigma, you know, when people are diagnosed as bipolar. But, you know, it's, it was good.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, I appreciate that so much. Yeah, and so, again, because this is a novel, this is not meant to feel academic or like I'm on a soapbox preaching or lecturing. The way that some of this discovery happens is through Maddie's comedy. And so that this distinction between am I bipolar or do I have bipolar, right?
Yeah.
She sort of weaves that into her comedy set in, I think, a lovely way. But yeah, I think that's important. I think this disorder is a crisis of identity in some ways, right? It's so big, so powerful. It does overtake and it can be so destructive. It leaves people wondering like, okay, is this who I am now? And how do I matter with this? Or how do I use this? This guy who's kind of an ex-boyfriend opens that door for her. You don't have to hide it. How do you use it? Don't let it overtake you, but it is part of you. So yeah, this distinction between I am bipolar versus I have bipolar. We don't do that with a lot of other illnesses. Like if we go back to Still Alice, I would never say I am Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I would say I have Alzheimer's disease. So yeah, she wrestled with that. And then yeah, there were lots of overlaps in this book, I think, between how women are treated and this idea of mental illness as well. There's a lot of feminism in this book, and
yeah.
It's a lot of my feminism I brought in, which I was very happy to use that in this story. She talks about how boys her age will dismiss their girlfriend if she's getting emotional and say, "Oh, you're bipolar," and mm-hmm. bipolar is interchangeable with like you're crazy, you're nuts, mm-hmm. You're unhinged. Me basically dismissing you. You're not worthy of listening to any further. And just how women can be dismissed if they're complaining of symptoms of depression to their primary care physician or their GYN. Like, oh, it's probably PMS.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me put you on birth control to fix that for you. Uh-huh. So I just, yeah, I wanted to bring up all the ways that maybe this is at first minimized and then over-dramatized or over-compensated for. And in both ends of that extreme, interestingly, like women get dismissed.
Maddie has another really great observation at one point, female comics are dangerous because they speak the truth. And I was like, ooh, good one. So, because Maddie has dreams of becoming a stand-up comic. So can you talk about where that inspiration for the story came from?
I knew I wanted some levity in this book. I needed some, in addition to all the drama and the sort of the heaviness of her depressions and the disruption to her life, I needed some levity in there. And I found my way to comedy in an interesting way. I think that I wanted her to have an interest that was outside of the norm that not many women are a part of. I wanted that feminist angle. And I also loved that in stand-up comedy, kind of as a metaphor, these comedians actually experience the swings of someone who has bipolar disorder on center stage under the spotlight in front of an audience in a public way. What I mean by that is, if you're a stand-up comic and you're bombing, you are not connecting with the audience, every joke is not landing, and you're just being met with silence and crossed arms, the comedians all will say, it feels like a death. It feels like the worst depression. You feel so alone and miserable, and you just want to curl into a ball or get the hell out of there. It's the worst feeling they've ever had.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
But on the flip side, when they're killing it and the jokes are landing and they're in connection with everyone in the audience and everybody's laughing and they're getting it and you just feel like everyone gets you, it's the biggest high. It is the most exhilarating feeling, and it's sort of addictive. Like, that's why comedians want to do it again. It's to chase that next connected laugh. And so I think that in that way, there's this interesting metaphor that being a comic can feel a bit moment to moment, like you're going through the swings of bipolar, manic, and depressive episodes, depending on how the audience is reacting. So that was kind of the idea. And I also thought that maybe, you know, people use humor to help them heal and understand and cope. And I thought that maybe giving Maddie this pursuit of comedy would give her a chance to process some of what's going on in a way that could be funny and a way that we could laugh with her. And we could, you know, part of why I do what I do is I want to make these topics accessible and approachable, conversational, like not taboo. And humor is such a great way to do that. That being said, that was probably the most challenging thing for me. It was, I don't write stand-up comedy, so I had to learn. I took a stand-up comedy writing class out of New York. I did a 5-minute set, and I really worked hard to develop Maddie's comedy within this novel. It was fun.
There, you have jokes that land, right? I mean, there Yay! Are some laugh out loud moments for
oh,
sure.
Good.
I just kept thinking that's a commitment to your craft too. You know. Take that on of, I'm going to learn some stand-up comedy and I'm going to perform a set so that I can write about it.
Yeah, thank you. And when I first signed up for the class, I explained to the instructor, I'm like, well, look, you know, I'm writing from the perspective of a 20-year-old. And so I'm going to do my class as if I'm her and tell the jokes of a 20-year-old. And he's immediately said, no, you're not doing that. You're going to tell your jokes as you, you know, however, like 52-year-old Lisa at the time. And he's like, and yeah, that was the requirement. And I immediately was like, oh, shoot. I have to be that vulnerable. Okay. Shoot. All right.
And we really did learn quite a bit about bipolar in reading More or Less Maddie. But really, you know, you talked about this earlier, the magic of fiction is that it can give us that compassionate and nuanced understanding. When we can put ourselves into the story, we do build empathy. So in writing the story, has there been, you know, one thing, I'm sure there's lots of things, but one thing that stands out that you learned about bipolar that will stay with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much, but one of the things I'd love to talk about is I think that one of my preconceptions going into this, in sort of obliquely hearing about friends of friends or people that I know that have bipolar disorder prior to this book, the conversations would be like, oh, so-and-so's not doing so well, or we haven't seen someone in a long time, or someone's, you know, missing from the family holiday, or something's gone on. And then the sentence goes, oh, they went off their meds. And then there's this sort of like silent agreement, and it's a judgment like, oh, well, then they brought it on themselves. They should know better. And what I came to appreciate in doing the research for this story and in talking with all the people I've spoken with and then in writing the story and what I hope I conveyed is how incredibly difficult it is to be on these medications. These medications cause all kinds of side effects that are tough to deal with, from hand tremor to weight gain to nausea to foggy thinking and dizziness. And this is, you know, every day indefinitely. The other thing I think that happens is that if the drugs are working and you're stable for a long time, say a year, 2 years, 10 years, and you're taking these medications every day and you haven't had a manic episode in years, you kind of forget how bad it was. I mean, I think about, I've had three kids, and I think that all women, we kind of forget how bad pregnancy and labor and delivery were. We're like, yeah, I'll have another kid. So I think time goes by. And by the way, when you're manic and depressed, you don't lay down memories as well as you would in a stable state. So like people who are manic don't, they have a fuzzy memory of that episode to begin with because the brain didn't consolidate memories properly during that time. And then time goes by and you kind of forget, and you might think, well, you know what, maybe it wasn't that bad. And oh, by the way, there's no blood test, no brain scan to diagnose this disease. There's no like quote unquote proof that you have this. So it's not like, oh, we saw the x-ray, we saw the MRI, we have the blood work. It's based on a conversation. And so you might think, well, maybe they were wrong. Maybe, you know what, I was so much younger then and I wasn't sleeping much. And maybe it was just, you know, I was really stressed out and overwhelmed. I think I'm going to try going off the meds. And so what I learned, and that was a long circuitous way of saying, like, it makes so much sense to me that you try to go off your meds at some point. And that we shouldn't villainize folks for doing so. Like, I hope to hold, I know personally I will hold more space and compassion and gentle kindness toward folks who go off their meds. Because it's like, yeah, that makes sense. What do you need now? How can I help?
Is there some parting words of advice that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so... sure. Yeah. And actually, we can relate that to this current book, too. So one of the key triggers that can cause an episode of mania or depression, but primarily mania, is lack of sleep or sleep disruption. So sleep disruption is huge in mental health. Or I should say sleep hygiene is important for mental health. And it's important for the health of your brain today and for preventing neurological diseases like Alzheimer's in the future. So a couple things about sleep for everybody. We need 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. That's optimal. And it's because we're not in a state of unconsciousness doing nothing. We're very biologically busy while we sleep. And so during the phases of sleep, there are specific nuanced things going on in your brain and body that help fight infection and cancer. And in your brain, the janitors of your brain, the sewage and sanitation department, gets to work. And it's very busy cleaning and clearing away the metabolic debris that accumulated while you're in the business of being awake. So it's when you consolidate memories. So everything that you learn today that you care about, that you want to remember tomorrow, becomes linked together as a memory while you sleep. And so if you don't get the right amount of sleep, your brain isn't cleaned up enough the next day. Your memories might not be fully formed or formed at all from yesterday. You'll have a hard time paying attention today if I didn't get a good night's sleep last night. So for optimal brain functioning, all the neuroscientists I know make sleep a priority.
I think I know what my New Year's intention yeah, is like, now, oh, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No. And by the way, and folks, don't give up because, like, oh, I had, you know, I'm in menopause now and I've had like horrible time getting to sleep. And at all points of life, people have difficulty with sleeping. I totally recognize that. So you don't have to say, well, oh, I got a terrible night's sleep last night and therefore I won't try anymore. I'm hopeless. It's like, well, every night that you can give yourself a good night's sleep, I feel good about that. Know that you're doing something that's really great for your brain and the health of your cognitive abilities.
Thank you for such a great conversation today, Lisa, and for giving readers a place in More or Less Maddie to start more conversations about mental health.
Oh my goodness. Thank you very much for reading it and asking such wonderful questions. I really appreciate you.